Wilbur Topkin. That's right. Now let's work it out. What he's saying is, when God gets ready to bless the church and the world, he picks out a man and works out the principles that are going to bless the world and the church through that man. So the three elements here are God's going to bless the church and the world through principles. He needs a model for the principles. He picks out a man to model the principles. Does that sound okay here? Emerson said that an institution is the lengthened shadow of one man. Do you agree with that? Now, as far as the navigators are concerned, we would probably substitute a word and say that a movement is the lengthened shadow of a man. So if we're making any progress here, what we're saying is that when God gets ready to bless the church and the world through a principle, he picks out a man to model the principle. And then the movement becomes the lengthened shadow of that man. So we want to go into a little background on this man. When he was 22 years old, Dawson Trotman wrote a letter to the president of Dallas Theological Seminary. And I've got the entire letter here of this 21-year-old man. And as we go through it, look for some things that were strong in his life, then we'll review them, okay? Now, ordinarily, I'd have one of you read it, but since we're trying to get a good tape here, I'll read it this time, so follow along. See, this was written January 16, 1928. Dear Sirs, I'm writing to you for advice in a matter of much importance to me. I graduated from high school in June 1928. Owing to the fact that I had little or no ambition in life, my education was sadly neglected. I've worked these 4.5 years, 2 in selling dry goods and furniture, and the remaining 2.5 years in a lumber yard. I'm now driving a Ross Carrier in a lumber yard, and I'm nearly 22. Now, just to lighten it up a little bit, do you know what a Ross lumber carrier is? Well, a lumber yard, they move big batches of 2x4s, 2x8s, and they have a high wheel carrier that has forklifts underneath. So you just run over, straddle a pile, put the forklift under, lift it up, and move it where they want to move it. Now, it would cost a lot of time to turn around and maneuver that thing. So it's built like a ferry boat. It goes forwards and backwards. You're not going to go forward this way and one the other. So Dawson Trotman spent 2.5 years driving one of these things. Now, when I first knew him, the traffic wasn't like it is today. Maybe there'll be one car on a block. So I discovered that when he got ready to go someplace in his car, he'd go out and climb in. He'd look to see which street was the closest, forward or backward. And if the street behind was closer to one in front, he just backed to the street back there because he could back just as drive just well backwards as he could forward. So he found out that was a lot of fun, and he did it sometimes whether the corner behind was the closest or not, just to kind of catch people off guard. Okay, he said, after a year and a half, I was converted from a wild life, drinking, gambling, thieving, lying, smoking, so forth, having had a part of my makeup. I'm now saved by grace, and I have had victory in overcoming all these wild habits. Perhaps one of the most rotten dispositions, also having been defeated through the power of Jesus Christ. I've been the president of one of the liveliest Christian Endeavor societies for a year and have spent many precious moments in service for him. I have preached 2 sermons and have given many talks and am not afraid to stand out anywhere and preach the gospel. My happiest moments are spent in dealing with men, boys, and girls about Jesus Christ. As a fisherman, Matthew 4:19, I have won two souls to Christ. I say this only that you might know the little experience I've had. I love to pray, having had real burdens and delight in reading God's Word. I've memorized 10 chapters of the Bible and can quote about 120 passages, being able to tell where they are. I memorize while I work. Having set my goal for souls high, I must do big things for the Master. And I look to you as having had practical experience to advise me as to preparation, realizing my utter inability to do anything but by and through Him. Expository preaching holds much attraction to me. Thank you kindly for your service. Yours respectfully, Dawson Trotman. I'm just beginning a course in better English with the International Correspondence Schools. Now, as you looked at that letter, could you get any clue as to some of his values and motivations? What were some of them?
Personal excellence.
Okay. What else?
The dependency of Jesus Christ.
Okay.
The Word of God. Prayer.
Do you recognize any of these things that have been emphasized in this conference? So here's the young man with these values. Now, about the time he became a Christian, he expected that other people his age would have the same degree of motivation and ambition that he had. But that was not true. He put together several teams. The first one he called a gospel team, and then the second one he called the Fisherman's Club. And it was a part of an international organization. Then he organized the Minutemen. But he didn't have a great deal of success with these groups because they weren't wholehearted as he was. He had a mentor, a pastor, Vernon Morgan, and he helped him in his Christian life. But he had worked out, Morgan had, what he thought was the essential input to get the proper output. In other words, how to maintain a vital, vibrant, productive Christian life. And in those days, if you wanted some milk, you didn't go to the 7-Eleven or dairy store, but you had a cow. And cows had to be milked. And it's kind of an awkward job to milk a cow. You can't do it standing up. And if you try to get on your knees, you might not find a real sanitary spot to get on your knees. So somebody invented what they call a milk stool. Now, just like a 2x8 with three legs in it, bore a hole, stick a peg here, here, and here. Well, in order for it to set upright, you had to put your weight equally, you know, on all three. If you leaned any way, why, it would turn over. So Morgan figured out, now, the three essentials in the Christian life are the Word, prayer, and witnessing. As long as these three elements are in there, in balance, why, you know, you have a successful Christian life. But Trotman didn't buy this wholeheartedly. The first place, the idea of sitting down didn't appeal to him, particularly the Christian life. And then he said, I know people that read the Bible, who pray, and who witness, but they have such a sour disposition. Nobody had ever listened to them. So he came up with his own illustration, a little bit different than the one that you've picked up today, with the Word, prayer, witnessing. He put a fourth spoke in there, which he called living the life. And his verse for that was Colossians 3:23, "Whatsoever you do, do it heartily, as unto the Lord, and not unto men." You know, that's, and I think that was a good spoke. Now, it's been modified down through the years over the dead bodies of some of us. But it has been, nevertheless, on that. So he tried to help these guys around him with a little bit of discipline. You know, the wheel and other things. So his Minutemen team, they got together and discussed what disciplines they wanted to impose upon themselves. So here's the first nine they had. Memorize a verse a day. Have an hour a day with the Lord. Touch a life a day. Have a definite work to do each week. Keep a journal. Have ammunition ready. He meant always carry a tract or Gospel John. Have team business up to date. Read 2 hours a week. Tackle own task. No, complete a project of some kind every week. Well, they thought this might be a little too hard. So they worked on revising it, and the revision added three more. And they were, memorize a half a hymn a week, review 7 verses a day, spend some definite time on our filing system. He was a very orderly person. Probably one time in his life he used the same filing system I do, which is called the Hunt system. Works out real well most of the time. Now, at the dedication of Glen Erie, Dr. Bob Munger, who knew quite a bit about the Navigators, mentioned this in his dedicatory address. He said, "Discipline without desire is drudgery." That makes sense here? So he had a bunch of people around him that just didn't have the desire. And they faded. He was so concerned about this that he got together with one of the guys, Walt Stanton. And he said, "Walt, would you join me to pray for these other guys on the team?" And Walt said, "Be glad to." He said, "I'll pick you up at 3:30 in the morning." And Walt thought he said 3:30 in the morning. And Walt was right. He said 3:30 in the morning. So Dawson Trotman picked him up in his motorcycle, and they went down to a little ravine. I was down there a few years ago, and the city of Torrance, California, has built an airport right up at the top of the ravine. We tried to duplicate the prayer meeting, but you couldn't even hear one another talk with the planes taking off and landing. But it was a little quieter in that day. And they built a fire, and during the week would pray from 4 to 6 before going to work. Now, they probably had less than a dozen fellows they wanted to pray for. I don't know whether you have been in a 2-hour prayer meeting recently or not. But two guys can cover a lot of territory in 2 hours. In fact, you can pray everything you can think of for half a dozen people. And then you can do it twice in 2 hours, and then 3 times and 4 times. So for the first few days, they just prayed themselves out over these guys. Then they said the burden didn't lift to pray. And they said, "Well, we know other people like this." So for a few days, they prayed for other people. Now, how to describe what they were praying for is not all that easy. Those of you who've been around the Navigators for a while know that we have lots of profiles on, now here's the kind of person we're looking for, and we revise that all the time. But Dawson Trotman just had one expression. He says, "Down to business." You know, he wants guys that are down to business for Christ. That was the most he ever elaborated on that. Well, pretty soon they exhausted everybody they could think of, everybody they knew. And they said, well, I bet there's people like this in San Francisco and in San Diego. Let's pray for them. And then in Seattle and Portland and then west, until they prayed for all 48 states. You know, now God, would you just raise up some young men that are down to business for you in these 48 states? 4 weeks went by, and the burden didn't lift. The last week of the prayer meeting, they took a map of the world and put their fingers on various cities and countries and said, God, would you raise up some young men like this, down to business, in that country? After 6 weeks, it seemed like the burden lifted. They felt they'd done what they needed to do, so the prayer meeting terminated and they went home. Now, I asked Dawson Trotman once, do you remember what countries and cities you prayed for? I said, well, I remember a few of them. I can tell you a few of them, but I don't remember all of them. Today, the Navigators are active in 102 countries of the world. So we could probably eventually reconstruct that prayer meeting on a map. I think we've got a few years to go there, but they might have prayed for all the countries that were in existence at that time. I don't know. The next couple of years, Dawson Trotman went to school 1 year at a Baptist seminary, another year at the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, and got married all those 2 years. One of his classmates in the Bible Institute of Los Angeles was a very fine young lady named Helen Rittenhouse. Helen Rittenhouse lived in San Diego, and she and her mother attended the First Baptist Church. And San Diego was one of the four Navy recruit training stations. So every Sunday, a few of these recruits would wander into the church, you know, had probably a good Christian background. So Helen Rittenhouse and her mother would take a few of them and invite them out to their house, give them a good home-cut meal, and then do a Bible study in the afternoon. One of the fellows that came to their home was a young sailor from Illinois by the name of Lester Spencer. He, like many people in that day, there was no such thing as a GI Bill or a college loan. If you had the money, you could go to college. If you didn't have the money, you couldn't go to college. You know, just that simple. So he came to the Navy to save some money so I could go to college, go to seminary, and become a pastor. Now, I gave you a handout here from Time magazine. It was written up after Dawson Trotman's death. And if you take a look under his picture there in the second paragraph, we'll come back to another part of this in a little bit. But the second sentence in the second paragraph under his picture, one day in 1934, a mother asked him to look up her son, a sailor on a ship off Long Beach. Sitting in his old car by the waterfront, Trotman quoted the Bible to the boy until a policeman grew suspicious. A few minutes later, Trotman had talked the cop into joining him and the sailor in a session of prayer. The sailor said, I'd give my right arm if I could do what you just did. Dawson challenged him to try. It was the beginning of a movement Trotman called the Navigators for its nautical origin. For that sailor converted a friend with the technique he had learned from Dawson Trotman, and that convert in turn convinced another. Soon Navigators were spread across the seven seas. At one point during the war, there were Navigators in more than 1,000 U.S. Navy ships and stations. Now I want to give you another account of this. None of you are old enough to remember the 1920s and mid-30s. But it was a time of extreme pacifism in the U.S. I joined the Navy in 1932. I think the year was 1934 that Congress refused to appropriate money for fuel for the Navy. So we swung around the answer for 1 year because there was no money available to buy fuel for maneuvers. The American people didn't want to be involved in anything military, and the kind of saying it passed around was that we've got two great allies, the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean, and so we don't need anything, any more allies and or any more involvement. Well, the Navy knew that Japan was fortifying islands out in the Pacific, and our defenses were weak. We didn't have enough ships. And they tried to get Congress to appropriate some money, you know, to build up so they could do their job. But Congress wouldn't come through. In fact, we had one admiral that asked for $5 million to build an air base on Guam. And three congressmen asked the Secretary of the Navy to court-martial him for being a warmonger. Well, the Navy took matters in their own hands and invited 20 of the leading journalists in the United States to take a tour of the South Pacific at their expense to see what we needed out there, and hoping they could stir up public opinion. One of the 20 who accepted this invitation was Walter Davenport. He was the political editor of Collier's magazine, Cost a Nickel, circulated every week, and was probably the most wide-read magazine in America during that time. So the Navy sat back, what are these guys going to do to help us? Well, they must have been shocked after Walter Davenport wrote his first article. It was entitled, Onward Christian Sailors. This was in the issue of September 13, 1941. And it says, they pray as they work, they sing songs unto the Lord as they go down to the sea, they rejoice with left hooks when men revile them, and they're just enlisted men in the United States Navy. Stephen Decatur turns in his grave. John Paul Jones rubs his hollow eyes. And Farragut stops damning torpedoes. It's amazing. So he goes on to tell about the Navy flew him out to San Francisco. He went aboard the battleship California. And in writing the article, he said that his first night on the ship, he was being escorted around, explained what the Navy was all about. And he said, I grabbed the escort's arm. I said, wait a minute, what's this? Gobbs, your gentleman, I had just seen something. Four sailors, trim as new sloops, but with their faces set in grim lines, were about to go ashore. Under their arms, clamped tight to their ribs, they carried Bibles. Just before they descended into the boat, one of them, a little taller than the other, I guess he was about 25, had a big hawk face, wide shoulders, hairy hands, and one glance told you it would be very bad judgment to invite him to step out in the alley. His sharp, weathered face lifted toward the clear sky. His eyes closed, his lips moved, and his companions bowed their heads. The silent prayer lasted but a moment, and then all four went down to the boat, stern, aloof, resolute. Navigators, explained Mr. Murphy. They're new, too. We've got about 12 of them on the California. Tomorrow we've got maybe 18 or 20. They're always working on the wicked, converting sinners, holding revivals, and praying for lost souls. Every ship in the fleet's got some. I don't know how many, and they ain't saying. And so forth. Then he said, now, before we go further, I should explain to my readers who the navigators are. You ever get asked that question? Who are the navigators? Well, he stumbled around and he said, the navigators isn't a religion, nor is it a distinct denomination. It isn't a cult. And that Mr. Bell, a man of comprehensive simplicity, was unable to state a clear definition. So he got kind of confused who they were. But he gave a little history. And he talks about Mr. Trotman, who worked in the lumberyard, and said, like Paul, bound for Damascus, breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, Mr. Trotman stopped in his tracks, renounced Satan, quit the lumberyard, and began redeeming sailors from sin. The Lord smiled on his work from the beginning, starting with a new strength, a new faith, a worn Bible, and four sailors. Mr. Trotman is now the head of a way of life. Mr. Bell refuses to say organization that is followed by hundreds of blue jackets, the navigators. This was 1941. Now, each of these articles has considerable truth in it. But we're here to talk about navigator history, and I'd like to, for you to get the truth. In 1983, we had a reunion. A bunch of guys had been together 50 years ago, and we asked this sailor to repeat once again the story of how he met Dawson Trotman and what happened. And I've got it on tape here. And we're going to play it, and I'm supposed to make sure it gets in the mic this time. So let me know if it's not loud enough in the back seat, and I'll turn it up a little bit. This is a picture of the guy at the time this was made.
I had some real good input from Helen. She had it all organized, and it was great. And by that time, I'd realized that I should back up and say that I was saved when I went into the service. I accepted the Lord when I was 11 years old in Laramie, Wyoming, but had never grown to speak of, because in those days, we didn't have vacation Bible schools or Bible camps, Awanas, or those things. But my parents were very faithful in keeping us in Sunday school and in church. And I know there are days when my mother didn't have shoes that was fit to go to church in. But she thought to that we had clothes and were properly dressed to go to Sunday school and church. So I was saved when I went into the service and began to realize that God had a purpose for my life. And so when it came time for me to be transferred to the fleet, I didn't request an assignment at all. And I just committed it to the Lord. I said, you send me where I belong. And you know the story that I was sent to the USS West Virginia up in San Pedro Harbor. And with that move, I was within 5 miles of Dawson Trotman. Very interesting how it all worked out geographically. And Helen and Dawson were in Biola together. And when I went to San Pedro, Helen wrote Doss and said, look him up. Look me up, but I needed help. And that's right. And as you probably know also, it was Doss's habit, before he went to work every morning, he would set aside a little time to go up in those Palo Verdes hills north of San Pedro and spend some time with the Lord. And he was very organized, had his little book, and my name was on one of those pages. I don't know whether it was now, soon, or later. But anyway, on that particular morning, my name was on the page that Doss was dealing with. So he said, I've got to look that fellow up. So quickly he closed up his book, got in his car, and headed toward Trona Field. Any of you know about Trona Field? Yeah. Installation there of the Navy and communications center. So Doss rushed down to Trona Field and sent a radiogram to me on the West Virginia. And the message read something like this. Said, meet me at the dock at 4 o'clock. I'll be wearing a light coat, dark trousers, tan shoes, Dawson Trotman. Now, he had given the name of Rittenhouse originally for that message to be included in that message. But that hadn't gotten in there. So, about 8:30, I was cleaning up the dishes. I was mess cooking, hadn't been on the ship too long. And a fellow from topside, whose name was Spencer, I hadn't met him, came and handed me this message. He said, is your name, first name Lester? I said, yes. He said, well, then this must be for you. So I stopped long enough to read it, and I just sort of shook my head. As you know, there's all kind of con games to separate a serviceman from his money. And I thought, something's going on here like that. So I just folded it and put it in my little pocket there in the white. But all day long, I was going to ignore it. All day long, the Lord didn't let me forget it, though. I said, so how did he get my name? Where in the world did he have any contact with me? So that just kept bugging me. So I got someone to take care of the evening meal, and I said, well, I'll go over and see what this is all about. But I left all my money aboard except 25 cents for a water taxi home. I was there a little bit before 4, and after a while, amongst all those blue uniforms, I saw a civilian. And he was looking around. I thought, well, this must be the man. So I got up, went over to him, and I said, are you Trotman? Yes. You Spencer? Yes. And then he told me who he was and what it was all about. And then he said, how'd you like to go home with me tonight to a chicken dinner? And you know my response. And he said, I called Lila after I sent that message, and she's prepared a chicken dinner for us. You remember that, Lila? So before long, we arrived at his home. A lovely time, lovely dinner. And then Doc said, let's go out and have a little fellowship around the word. I said, fine. He had a Chevy 2-door coupe. So we got in that car and wound our way up the hills there and came to a place in the road that was wide enough for a car to pull out and park. And I learned later that this was Lover's Lane. That's why the policeman was a little suspicious. But we had settled in there, was reading the scripture, Doc was reading, he had turned on the little light above. And I was on the passenger side. All of a sudden, there was a knock on the window right by me. And I looked up, and here was a policeman with a big star. And he knocked again, and I rolled down the window. And he said, what are you guys doing here? And one of the things that I always admired in Don, he was always quick on the trigger. And he says, well, sir, we're reading the Bible. Is that all right? And you can see amazement written all over his face. There was a moment silence, and Doss picked it up just like that. He says, well, he says, if you don't believe us, he told us that he was a guard of the school. There's a big laurel hedge about 20 feet high there. And he told us that he was a guard for that school. And Doss said, well, if you don't believe us, you just go in and unlock one of those schoolrooms, turn on the light, and we'll prove it to you. And so he said, okay. So he led us down into the schoolroom, turned on the light, and Doc began to deal with him. And the thing, I guess, that impressed me most about that whole thing was Doc's knowledge of the word and his skill in using it. This fella brought up all kinds of questions, and Doss didn't argue with him at all. And he had the ladder on his Bible, and he would flip that over, and many times right to the page. And he'd say, sir, would you read this, please? The fella would read, and then he'd bring up something else. And this happened for about 20 minutes. And finally, this fella had nothing more to say. And so Doss pressed him then for a decision. And he said, well, not now. I'm not ready. So we went on our way up the path, and I was so amazed. I'd never seen anybody handle the Bible like that before. And I said to him as we walked out, I said, Doss, that was great. And I said, you know, I'd give a right arm if I could do that. And he says, oh, no, you wouldn't. You see, he was baiting me. And he was really setting me up for something he had in mind. I had already been prepared because of experience on the ship. Fellas, you know, want to take you ashore and get you into all kinds of troubles. And I wouldn't go. And this happened two or three times. And finally, this one fellow said, you don't go with us. You think you're too good for us? And I said, no, I don't think I'm too good for you. But I said, I'm a Christian and I don't do those things. And we were in the compartment there and several of the guys around. And he, you know, let out a yell. He says, hey, guys, come on over here. We've got a real live one. You know, and then it started. About six or seven of them. Word came, get his wife. And all of these things that I didn't know anything about. And I felt so bad because I just felt I was letting the Lord down. And I got out of those situations as quickly as I could. But it happened over and over again, several times, you know. They were having fun. They thought they were. So I had been prepared on that side of it. And then Doss, as we walked on up the road, I said, well, Doss, I really mean that. I don't think so. And that carried on until we got to the car. And then we just got seated there a little bit. And he said, you know, he said, you can do that too if you want, if you're willing to work and study, and you won't lose your right arm either. And I said, well, what do you have in mind? And you know what he had in mind.
When I think about God raising up the navigators, I think about Gideon and his 300. Remember when he mobilized the army, he had 22,000. And in those days, when the army was mobilized, there was a speech written out in Deuteronomy chapter 20, what you're supposed to do. And the first thing in the speech was, if you're a coward, you go home. You will not only not do any good in the battle, but you'll demoralize others. So 22,000 of his 32,000 went home. No heart for the battle. Then he took the 10,000 left and gave them a little test. And 9,700 flunked the test. They had the heart, but not the skill. With the 300, God says, I'm going to conquer this 145,000 army with the 300. They had both the heart and the skill. Now, here you see a young guy. He really had a heart to serve God. He came in the Navy to get ready to become a pastor. But he said he felt so bad because he let the Lord down. He had no skills, you know, in handling the Word or dealing with people. So one of the primary reasons, I think, that God has raised up the navigators is to impart skills. And that's what Dawson Trotman did for him. I came aboard the same battleship about 2 months before Lester Spencer did. And I was anxious to succeed in the Navy and try to figure out how it worked. So the first thing I discovered is, if I'd show up for work 5 minutes before anybody else and stay 5 minutes after everybody else left, you'd soon be in charge of the operation. So here is a seaman, brand new. I had a supervisor position, of 90 guys that were the mess cooks that Spencer was one of. And my job was to see that after every meal that they did a good job cleaning up their coffee pot, dish pan, sanitary. So I saw Spencer three times a day. He'd bring his coffee pot and his stuff up, and I'd take the flashlight, tell him whether it was okay, whether he had to go back and do it over again. Well, my first Christmas away from home, my mother gave me a Bible, and she never told me what to do with it. And I thought kind of a good luck charm or something. But I thought it was a pretty safe place to keep any extra money I had. So that's where I kept my dollar bills. One day, another friend of mine wanted to borrow a couple of bucks, and I told him to come by. And I opened up the Bible, took out the $2 and gave to him. And Spencer saw me. And he said, you know, that Bible's good for something else besides just keeping your money in. And then a few days later, he showed up with a black eye. And I told him, you know, if you had to sell the bars, you wouldn't get beat up. And he said, I didn't get that in the bar. I got that black eye playing football. And he said, I'm a Christian. Well, Dawson Trotman had begun to work with him, you know, he having an outreach. So since I saw him three times a day, every once in a while, you know, he would just drop in a word of witness. Well, in carrying out what Trotman was teaching him, he looked around for somebody, you know, to help in his Christian life and to lead to Christ as well as evangelize. He found another fellow named Gurney Harris. That's very interesting. His story was the same. He came in the Navy, save his money, go to college and seminary, and become a pastor. This is his picture. They, of course, became good friends. That's Dawson Trotman's oldest child. He spent his life in Africa as a missionary. But he was an athlete. He was on the ship's swimming team. So Lester took him over to meet Dawson Trotman. And when he introduced him, he said, now, here's a man that needs what you're teaching me a lot worse than I did. He had been in the Navy almost 4 years and had kind of lost his vision. And so this was a very historic moment in Navigator history. Trotman almost said, fine. But then he hesitated, and he said, what's wrong with you teaching him what I've taught you? And Spencer, oh, I could never do that, you know. But Trotman was serious, and he said, during those early years, we never heard much about 2 Timothy 2:2. But after World War II, the interest in the Navigators went down. And many people thought God had raised up the Navigators just to have a ministry during World War II. So some of our guys were kind of unemployed. And so some of them got together in what we would call a think tank today. And they said, now, God has marvelously blessed the Navigators during these war years. We must have been doing something right. If we were doing something right, it must be in the Bible. Let's see if we can find it. So one day they ran across 2 Timothy 2:2. And I said, this is it. This is it. Trotman refused to teach Harris. He said, you teach it. I've got Spencer's account of this on videotape. I didn't bring it along, but he rehearsed this, exactly what Dawson Trotman told him. You teach it. So, Harris, as I said, was an athlete. He was a swimmer. There were two guys on the swimming team. One was an agnostic, one was an atheist. But they were attracted at his quality of life. Harris was a very winsome personality, a handsome guy here. And they began to hang out with him. You know, what makes you different? So he took them over to meet Dawson Trotman. And for 6 months, Trotman pounded away at them with Scripture. Now, one of these two was Dr. Edward Goodrick. If you own an NIV concordance put out by Zondervan, there's seven of them, all the way from exhaustive down to a small one, look about who put it together. Edward W. Goodrick. He was one of that four that Tosham Trotman contacted. He and I had gone through recruit training together, and we developed a friendship. We used to play chess once a week, and just because of our friendship, we got together and just talked about once a week. Well, he told me what was going on. Hey, I've been invited to go over and meet this guy. And his story was a little bit different than it really was. He said, this guy thinks he's pretty sharp, this guy Trotman, but I put him in his place. You know, I showed him where he was wrong and so forth. This went on for about 6 months. And then I noticed a tremendous difference in him. His arrogance, you know, began to disappear. And he showed a genuine interest in me. So I knew something had really happened. Well, all four of these first four were friends of mine. And they all zeroed in on me. I had gotten an appointment to West Point about this time. And the executive officer of the ship thought it would be something to have a sailor go to West Point. So he gave me a year off to study for the exam and appointed three officers to tutor me for the exam. So I put the guys off. I said, I'm too busy to have anything to do with you. But about the end of that time, there was a fifth guy came along named Virgil Hook. Can you believe it? Same story. Came in the Navy, saved money, go to college and seminary and become a pastor. And he was a very winsome, outgoing guy. I was on a work detail with him one morning. The Navy was small in those days, but once a quarter, they'd bring a refrigeration ship into the fleet and dump off enough meat, frozen meat, to last them for another 3 months. Well, there had to be a way to get that meat out of the refrigeration hold up topside and into the ship. So Virgil Hook, this fifth fellow, and I were detailed to go over and handle frozen beef. They got up at 3:30 in the morning, had cornbread and baked beans for breakfast, and went over, and I was very unhappy. I didn't remember anything in my contract about that. As far as I was concerned, this was a glamorous thing I was at, not good work like that. So I was very unhappy. But I noticed that Virgil, he was humming, singing, you know, having the time of his life. So I made an observation that any inward joy that I'd ever experienced was a result of outward favorable circumstances. If the circumstances surrounding me were favorable, I was happy. If they were unfavorable, I was unhappy. Here was a guy that circumstances couldn't touch. He was armored against them. So the first four guys gave me the theology and the truth. The fifth guy lived the life. Now, as you look back on your experience, probably the same thing. The critical mass that brought you to Christ was somebody who lived the life and went the second mile. Wasn't that it? It wasn't just knowing the truth. That's not what did it. It's seeing it in action. So I became a Christian as a result of that. Now I want to go back and review and kind of tie these things together. That you see Dawson Trotman's skepticism. Spencer said, okay, I'll do it. Trotman, oh no, you won't. I've heard that all my life, you know. Don't try to improve me. You won't do it. But Spencer was sincere. And for the first time in his life, Dawson Trotman met a man that bought the whole package. you know, without reservation. It's a new experience for Trotman. Then the second guy bought the whole package. And then the third and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth bought the whole package. Well, he was in paradise here. You know, all these guys responding. In the next two or three years, his house was filled with sailors. And he always tried to keep in touch with people that came to home, so he had to sign a register with your name, your military address, your home city, and your birthday. They're always trying to find some excuse to keep in touch. Well, I didn't want him to waste the postage on me, so I always put down my birthday, February 30. Well, after a while, he had quite an accumulation of these sheets, and he decided he'd discard them. And he just looked, saw several states, and he thought, I wonder how many states have been represented here. So he went through them, and men from every one of the 48 states had been in his living room. Now, two or three years earlier, he had prayed that God would raise up some people down to business in each of the 48 states. So it doesn't take too much smarts to put it together, does it? Here, I prayed God would bring men, you know, raise up men like this in every state, and here he's brought them into my living room. So he decided for the next few years, God was leading him to minister to servicemen. And he did. And as these articles point out, it spread pretty rapidly. Now, I didn't go in the Navy. I went in the Navy to save money, go to college, and go to law school. I was going to be a lawyer and then go into politics. But all the other guys got out. And Trotman saw there was a need for something more permanent, inside man. So we prayed, and I felt God led me. I didn't intend to make a career out of the Navy, but I would be that permanent party personnel. And it ended up, I stayed in the Navy for 24 years after that. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about what went on aboard ship. And there's a few books been written. I think this is the best one, called Valiant in Fight. I can tell you how to get a hold of a copy of this if you're interested, but it describes what went on in the 30s. A battleship had about 1,500 men. In those days, there was no radar, radio, satellites, newspapers. When that ship went over the horizon, it was like going into a black hole, because you're out of touch with everything until you come back up over the horizon. The routine on the ship was that you get up at 5:30, do a little cleanup, have breakfast at 7:30, go to work at 8, get off at 11:30, then work from 1 to 4. And then you had 4 to 5:30 eating meal to take care of personal things. Then they're free again from 5:30 after dinner to 7:30. If we weren't maneuvering or the weather wasn't bad, we always carried a cargo hold of old movies and set up on the fantail, room for all the ship's crew that wasn't on watch to go back. So at 7:30, everybody that wasn't on watch was back there at the movie. So our little Christian team, 15 minutes before every meal, the mess decks had to be cleared so these mess cooks carrying this hot food from the galley could spread out through the ship. So 15 minutes before every meal, the word came out, clear the mess decks. Well, our little Christian team met for prayer then, three times a day for 15 minutes. 5:30 after the evening meal, be through about 20 minutes, about 10 till 6. We had from 10 till 6 to 7:30 to evangelize. So we fanned out over the ship every day, all from 6 o'clock to 7:30. 7:30, everybody disappeared back to the movie. We met. Monday night, we spent that 2.5 hours studying a New Testament chapter. Tuesday night, we had an evangelistic Bible study. Wednesday night, we had a prayer meeting. Thursday night, we studied an Old Testament chapter. Friday night, we studied a topic. One of the guys wrote to one of our friends and said, tonight we've been studying about Satan, and we're all really filled with the subject. But can you imagine what kind of a hardcore team that kind of fellowship and study would create? On weekends, if we were out at sea, we'd have a weekend conference. Now, we didn't have a speaker, but we had a library of sermons of D.L. Moody and Schaefer, Billy Sunday, Torrey, who's Spurgeon. And so instead of having a speaker, we'd read the sermons. So we got familiar with all the sermons of all these guys, all they'd ever preached. And that was our routine aboard ship. That is the furnace in which the Navigator basics were proven, you know, to be workable. We saw what they would produce in that atmosphere. God chose a good laboratory to proof test these things that we practice today. We know they worked. Now, I should give you a war story or two, that after a fellow had been on the ship for 4 years, he could get transferred to another ship if he agreed to extend his enlistment for another 4 years. So that worked out fine. When a guy we felt was ready, at the end of his enlistment, he could go to a new ship, start a ministry over there. That's the way we spread out through the fleet. Well, I'll tell you just about one incident. We had a fellow named John Prince, and we thought he was ready to go to another ship, start a ministry. And we decided that the most strategic ship was the battleship California. So he did all the paperwork, got ready, went up, talked to the executive officer, and to ask to be transferred to the California. Well, we had prayed about it, and he came down to see me in my office. I was the only one of the guys that had a private office on the ship. And he was very dejected. And he said, I really blew it. I said, what do you mean you blew it? He said, I opened my mouth to say California, and Idaho came out. How could that happen? I don't know. He said it was a stupid thing to do, and I agreed with him that it was. But that wasn't God's strategy. Well, God had another strategy. So he went aboard the Idaho. He found out that he was a radioman. A radioman from the West Virginia had been discharged from the Navy. He reenlisted and went on the Idaho. So Prince had witnessed to him, and the guy was very hostile. And when Prince showed up, this guy, Alvin Abel was his name, he said, if you open your mouth about Jesus Christ. Now, he threatened him. I don't know what all he was going to do, but it was pretty serious threats. So John Prince told me later, he said, I shudder when I think about what I did. He said, I prayed that God would either convert him or remove him. Now, next part of the story. Some of you know NAV staff member Cece Davidson. You heard of him, one of our staff members. He was a radioman aboard the Idaho. He was not a Christian. He gave me a page out of his diary a while back, and I've got it here. And he tells about he got up at Reveille, helped clean up the compartment, had radio school, and this guy, Alvin Abel, borrowed $4 from him. And he said, Abel borrowed $4 from me to go out tonight. I warned him that he might get hit, run over by a truck, and I wouldn't be able to collect. He'll get my $4 back. Well, I guess he'd be careful. You know, I want my $4 back. Then he went on watch. And a message came from the shore patrol in Long Beach to the West Virginia. And it said, A.W. Abel, Seaman Second, died of unknown causes on the Long Beach Pike. So here he just loaned the guy $4, gets a message, you know, died of unknown causes. John Prince said, now Lord, either convert him or remove him. No wonder he said, I shudder at the request I prayed. His death certificate read just what it says here, unknown causes. No medical reason for his death on that. Well, we had a few Old Testament incidents like this going on. And we concluded that God was in charge of the Navy and pretty much placed it at our disposal. You know, Paul got free transportation from Jerusalem to Rome, courtesy of the government there. So we had a lot of support from the senior officers. You know, the captain of the ship, battleship, he realized he's got quite a large responsibility. He may not be able to handle it on his own. And he said, well, you know, God's going to look out for these guys. And so I get a free ride, you know, on this. And so now we had good receptivity on the ship from the more senior people because they recognized, you know, well, hey, if God's taking care of them, why, he'd take care of me also. Well, that's something about the life aboard ship. Now, there's a couple other things I want to cover here. That, you know, I don't want to boast unnecessarily, but, you know, you guys, Associated Navigators, in the major leagues of what God's doing. Can I bore you with a few figures here? In 1950, the population of the world was 2.5 billion. In 1980, it was 5.1 billion. Now, what does that equal percentage-wise? Doubled in that 40 years, right? In 1950, there were 80 million what you would call Great Commission Christians. Now, we'd call them disciples today, but the missiologists call them Great Commission Christians, and they describe him as a person who is interested in the Great Commission and wanted to do something to see this fulfilled. In 1989, there were 500 million Great Commission Christians. What's that figure out percentage-wise? 600% plus.
You go back,
yeah, 110% population. Yeah, so the population of the world doubled. The number of Great Commission went up 600%. Never happened in history before like that. Well, how do you account for it? We had a fellow named Harold DeGroff who ran the Navigator Ministry in Hawaii for 9 years. And when we started to have our first reunion, I asked him, do you have some old names and addresses that you might give me to write to people, tell them to come to the reunion? He was a CPA by profession. And he said, oh, yeah, I got a lot of them. And I said, could I have them? He said, well, there's quite a few of them. And I said, well, fine. When you say quite a few, how do you mean? He said, well, there were about 25,000. And he was very modest. And he said, you know, probably some of them signed their name more than once in that. 25,000 people went through his home, had some type of exposure in the 9 years he was there. Now, these guys, most of them, left the Navy. After World War II, they went to school. They hit their target in the early 50s. And they spent 40 years on the mission field. many of them, or in their community. And somehow, the number of Great Commission Christians increased 600%. Do you think they might have had been partly responsible for that? I'm sure there are many other factors, but in my mind, that was probably, they were the cutting edge of that movement that took place. Now, the world population is not static. The world population is increasing at the rate of 3.3 per second. Every day, the world logistics system has to absorb 250,000 new people. Every 4 days, you got another billion on Earth. Only a third of these are born into a situation where they'll hear the gospel. And that's two-thirds aren't. So what I'm saying, there's plenty to do. And, I mean, you guys, you're not out of a job yet, in spite of what's happened here. Although these statistics show that one out of every 10 persons alive today, one out of every 10, is a Great Commission Christian. Now, I'll just give you one other statistic. If God would decide, I'm going to divide the unsaved, give quota to every Christian, every born-in believer, there would only be seven apiece. God's done a lot in our generation, and he's doing a lot. And the Navigators have had their part. Now I want to open it up for some discussion and questions after I tell you one other story here. And then I want to try to, you know, wrap this and tie it together. Dawson Trotman, in that Time article you've got, toward the last, it says in 1953 he bought a large luxurious ranch outside of Colorado Springs for a retreat center and free vacation spot for Navigators. How many of you have been to Glen Eyrie? Well, for about $140 a night, why, you can get a free vacation. And, you know, I'm not faulting that because Glen Eyrie is a big operation, and in order to keep it solvent, why, people usually got to pay for it. But the staff can't afford it, and they hardly ever stay there. They stay with me or motel or someplace else, so it's not quite the free vacation spot, but it's a beautiful 515-acre estate. When the Navigators took it over, it had been practically unoccupied for 30 years. But the Navigators moved their offices there in 1954. Now, moving a big operation like that, why, you find out maybe there's a few things you haven't included in the planning, and one of them is an incinerator. You know, where do you burn papers? You know, a lot of paperwork every day. So the previous owner had had a makeshift incinerator. There's always a breeze blowing in Colorado, so you can't, you know, do anything outdoors. So he took, made some, about 6 by 8 squares out of concrete reinforcing rod, you know, just bent the corners, made it rectangle, and made 5 of these panels. Set them up in a square, put wire around, wire them together. Then he put one on top and wired it, and then the one in front just had a wire on one side, so you use it for a gate. So you put your papers in there and burn them, and they wouldn't blow away. But in 30 years, all the wire had rusted out, and the top was like this, the sides were apart. There were holes in every side and in the roof, and the door wouldn't close. So somebody apparently in the office said, what do you do with papers? Well, there's an incinerator down there. So some guy took some paper down there and burned it. And, of course, you know what happened. The wind caught it, went through one of the holes, set a grass fire, and it threatened the whole place. So it took 2 or 3 hours with the fire department and volunteers to put it out. After the fire was out, Dawson Drama gathered the crew around. Now, how'd the fire start? And they traced it down to this incinerator. Well, Dawson Trotman had a pretty low tolerance for stupidity. And he looked, the idea that an intelligent human being would start a fire inside of that thing, you know, he just could not comprehend how that would happen. So he expressed his dismay to the crew who had been fighting the fire. None of them did it, but he used them as an audience. And the more he thought about it, the more his blood pressure went up. Well, after explaining how he felt about it about three or four times, why the guys had been fighting fire, they were hot and sweaty, they wanted to, you know, get a shower and get on with what they were doing. Well, he didn't appreciate it when their attention span began to diminish a little bit. And he said, now you guys, you think I'm a perfectionist. And he said, you're right. I am. And he said, furthermore, if I were not a perfectionist, there would not be a Navigator ministry today. Let's think about that for a little bit. Here is his own evaluation as to why there's a Navigators today. Now, in a group this size, there's probably two or three of you that have perfectionist tendencies. And if you don't, your wife does. And a perfectionist is not easy to live with. My wife is not a strong perfectionist, but she has perfectionist tendencies, and I have to remind her occasionally that we are not in heaven. And the second law of thermodynamics is still in existence. Everything wears out, run down, rusts, and it won't stay new all the time. And that she has to tolerate some imperfections in me. But the perfectionist, hard to live with. You work on a project, you stay up till midnight, finally get it solved, and you go to bed happy, and you think the perfectionist is going to bed happy. Well, he gets up early in the morning and he says, now, there's got to be a better way to do this. You start all over again. And you work till midnight. You think you got it solved. Wake up in the morning. Now, I think there's probably a better way to do this. In the preamble to the United States Constitution, the writers didn't have an English teacher that helped them, because they said the reason for the Constitution is to have a more perfect union. And English teachers point out the redundancy of that, you know. It's either perfect. If it's perfect, right, it can't be more perfect. But Dawson Trotman, he didn't want everything to be perfect. He wanted to be more perfect. You know, that language fit him. Well, of course, his great concern is to get the gospel to the whole world. Now, if God commanded that this be done, he must have a plan. And if he has a plan, that's probably in the Bible. And if the fact that it hasn't been done, the plan hasn't been followed. What is the New Testament plan for reaching the world? So he concluded that, and rightly so, that the world would be populated with Christians the same way it's been populated with human beings. And that is through every generation reproducing after their kind. That's the way the world got populated. I sat down the other day and went through Adam's life from his birth to death and who was born in between, and assumed that each couple had 10 children, and each couple's lifespan was 500 years. And if those figures are accurate, the day before Adam died, he looked around and said to Eve, how many children, grandchildren, do we have, you think? more than a million. You look around and say, more than a million people here. They're all our children and grandchildren. That's the way the world was populated, was through reproduction. Now, if you've heard his tape, Born to Reproduce, he said, when a couple get married, and, you know, they want to have a family, and they don't have children, it's either because they are immature or sick. Period. So he said, when Christians do not reproduce, it's because they're either immature or they're sick. Pretty good conclusion, don't you think? So, the navigators, to the degree we follow his vision, we believe that we not only have the perfect way to reach the world, but we have the more perfect way to reach the world through spiritual reproduction. Kind of hard to get hold of sometime. Jim was trying to give us this last night. I just conclude before we have some discussion with one other story. One of the missionary executives today who is well known in Christian circles is Don Hamilton. He worked with Dawson Trotman for about a year and a half, attended his Bible studies, was on his ministry team in Pasadena, California. Talking to Don the other day, he said, I bet I know a story you haven't heard. I said, probably do. I'd be glad to hear it. He said, he told me I knew he'd been around Trotman during that year and a half. I said, we were out one day, and one of my friends, I said, hi, Don, I haven't seen you for a while. What are you doing? And I said, I'm a navigator. And after they went on their way, Trotman turned to him, and he said, did I hear you say you were a navigator? And, yeah. What makes you think you're a navigator? He said, well, I'm on your ministry team. I'm in your Bible studies. I'm in all your activities. Trotman said, you're no navigator. And Don Hamilton said, what do you mean? Trotman said, where are your spiritual grandchildren? Good question. What do you think? Jim touched on this last night. You know, that or some other speaker, where the greatest joy that you have is when somebody you've led to Christ leads somebody else to Christ. Well, that Jim was talking about that last night, wasn't he? Well, I think my monotonous voice has been exercised enough. If you have any comments or questions, I'll never cover everything I got in my notes here.
You didn't go to West Point after all?
No. You know, that the way God intervened to keep me from going to West Point, you know, I probably had the best preparation anybody ever had. My exec assigned the chaplain and three ensigns to tutor me because he wanted to get in. But God had other plans, and I'd either be a general or in a tombstone today. If I'd gone, I don't know why God intervened, and it wasn't because I wasn't prepared. No. Yeah.
Is Les still alive and still living in Beaverton, Oregon?
Les Spencer? Les? Here's a picture I got with his Christmas card. Pass it back there to him. He's 2 years older than I am, which means he's 86. I'm 84. Any other question or comment? Yeah.
In light of the history, what are some of your dreams as you look forward with the navigators?
In the book, Dosh, you know, he talked about 2 million people coming to Christ through the ministry. I think he far underestimated, you know, what would happen. I personally think that I try to figure now, when will God be the happiest? You know, if you can assign emotions to God. When everybody on earth is in his family, I think that's what he would like. Now, in order to get everybody in his family, you need disciples. To get disciples, you have to have disciple makers. And for disciple makers to operate efficiently, you have to have leaders. So I would say that God has done in my lifetime far beyond Ephesians 3:20 that I ever expected. So I place no limitation on what God's going to do. I was talking to one of our overseas leaders once, Latin America, and I said, what are your plans for reaching South America with the gospel? He said, I don't have any plans. But he said, I think God does. And his plan is dependent upon disciples. He cannot activate his plan without disciples. So, if I'll produce disciples, then God can activate his plan. So I think our job is not to have a strategy for the world, but any plan God has, I think, is dependent on disciples, disciple makers. So whatever I think, I believe Ephesians 3:20 will be fulfilled, that God's able to do exceeding abundantly above all you're able to ask or think. So I just know that's going to happen. Any other comment or question?
How about some frontman's family doing now, his wife and his children?
Lila is in a nursing home. I visited with her Tuesday this week. And three of her children live within a half mile. And the fourth one is moving from Phoenix this week. So she couldn't be happier family-wise to know that here she's in this nursing home because she's immobile, or she can't walk in a wheelchair. But to know that all four of her kids are less than a half mile away, she says, you know, that couldn't be better. She's very happy in the place she's in. As far as the kids are concerned, one of them is married to a former NAV staff member. Okay, anything else? Any comment or question? Well, appreciate you being here. And this is my fourth presentation, and none of them have been the same here.